Brittany DeYoung is the principal harpist with the Lansing Symphony Orchestra, and she is performing live for us here today in Studio S on WKAR's Current State. We're very happy to have Brittany here. This is an extraordinary instrument, not just to hear, but to be close to. This is probably the closest I've ever been to a harp, and it's an extraordinary creation, not only sonically, but physically as well. We'll learn more about the harp and hear a lot more music before the hour is through from Brittany DeYoung here on a Live Music Friday on Current State. I hope you can stay close. I'm Mark Bayshore. Earlier this week, our first guest on the program triggered an intense reaction when he suggested the Flint water crisis is overblown. Tuesday evening on Michigan Public Television, political journalist and commentator Bill Ballinger said, "I'm reading the same news media you are, and most of what's been written has been wrong, dead wrong." Over the years, Mr. Ballinger's become a fixture on Michigan's political landscape as a sought-after journalist and commentator. He's best known for launching and contributing to the newsletter Inside Michigan Politics. He's also been a regular on Michigan Public Television's Off the Record, which airs, of course, on WKAR-TV. Bill Ballinger, thanks for joining us today.
Good morning, Mark.
Your comments triggered all kinds of mostly negative reaction, but a little support as well. You're of the opinion that the media have not provided enough context regarding Flint. As specifically as possible, what's missing?
I would say not just historical data, but statistical data involving the testing for lead levels in blood of Flint residents. The geographical distribution of the children that supposedly have these elevated lead levels, the question of why, you know, there are confusing results of tests that show twins in the same house, one with elevated blood lead level and the other with none or below danger standards, family of five where one child had seven times the lead level in the child's blood that was acceptable, and the other four people in the household, two parents and two siblings, were well below that standard. Why could that happen? How could it happen? The media has been lazy in trying to ferret out the answers to these questions. If they don't know the answers, and it's pretty obvious that they don't, they should stop fanning the flames of panic in Flint and throughout the state and country and making it sound like this is an incredible health crisis where 100% of the population in Flint are endangered. That's simply not the case. I have a house in Flint. I live in Flint. I've been drinking the water consistently, unfiltered, for the last 2 years since it started drawing on the Flint River. I've had my blood tested. My lead level is totally safe. Everybody in my house and on my street the same way. All these questions are out there, and the media simply, in every sentence where it pronounces on the situation in Flint, makes it sound way worse than it really is.
Let's look at the data that has been reported. Quite a bit of this has been in circulation here in the last few days, and some of this you cited in at least one of your interviews on Tuesday. I'm pretty sure the following was on WJR. Data from the state finds high lead levels in 28 Flint children under the age of 6. Are you saying that that number is too low to warrant the response that the state is making?
Well, let's just say this. First of all, no more than 2% of the people in Flint have been affected according to lead levels in their blood according to these tests. Now, you can make an argument, Mark, that 28 is 28 too many, right? There should be zero. If that's the standard, Mark, you can go to the city of Grand Rapids, the city of Detroit right now, right now. Let's not wait. Let's do it right now. And you're going to find lead levels of children in those communities much higher than they are in Flint. And that is on the state Health and Human Services website. That's known to state and federal authorities. So the idea that Flint somehow, because 28 children have been identified with elevated lead levels, that Flint is a catastrophe and everybody else is safe, is wrong, dead wrong.
Well, now, with regard to Flint here specifically, what you're saying sounds to sounds as if it completely contradicts a comment by Dr. Mona Hanna Attisha on CNN yesterday. And specifically, this is about how much of the community has been impacted. We do have the audio with the CNN interviewer posing the question. So we'll air the question and the answer. Let's listen and then get your response.
Is there any chance in what you saw in your research that it was just a pocket of the community? It wasn't that widespread, that this wasn't something that's being described as a pandemic?
No, the entire city was exposed. Every neighborhood had high water lead levels, and every neighborhood had children with high blood lead levels.
Okay, are you on just completely different planets here from Dr. Hanna Attisha? She says the whole community's been impacted. You suggested in your earlier comments that that's not the case.
I had not heard that quote before. I'm amazed at it. I am okay with her first sentence. Yes. Every community in Flint has been affected by the water it imbibes from the Flint River through the pipes in the system. But when she says that, at least that was the implication, it seemed to me, this, what she said badly needs a follow-up question, which I'm sure it never got from Chris Cuomo, is, are you saying that everybody in the city had elevated blood lead levels as a result of this? Is that what you're saying? Or was she saying the distribution of the children with elevated blood lead levels came pretty uniformly throughout the community? It wasn't isolated in one geographical area. I'm not sure what she said. And if you listen carefully, Mark, you couldn't really tell what she was saying. It needed a follow-up question. Let me just say this. The zip code I live in Flint, is one of the two zip codes with the highest contamination levels recorded or reported yet, or with susceptibility to being contaminated by lead in the water. My zip code that I live in, 48503, okay? It's documented. So, you know, evidently from what Dr. Mona Attisha was saying just now, that could be true, but that there are evidences, let's say, out of these 28 children, that they're distributed throughout the community. Maybe, you know, 10 out of the 28 are from my zip code, but the other 18 are distributed throughout the city. We're not really sure. But again, we're talking about 2% of the population. Let me just mention one thing. There is a study, a report that's been put out. It's online. I urge all your listeners right now to go look it up and read it thoroughly. It's from Kettering University. It's from the president, Robert McMahon, MC, capital M-A-H-A-N. It's to all the faculty and students at Kettering University, which is the alma mater of General Motors President Mary Barra, a very highly regarded institution. And what is in that report, I think, will clarify a lot of things for a lot of people. Everybody I've referred this report to has said, you know, I come away now understanding a heck of a lot better what's going on in Flint and what's not going on in Flint.
Now, I wanted to get to Dr. McMahon's letter here, and we'll try to return to that here if we have time. But there's a really central point here that strikes me as being really important, and I want to ask you what you think about it. We have all heard health officials point out that lead does not remain in the system for very long. So 28 kids may have registered a high number when they were tested, but since lead doesn't stay in the system long, many, many others could have been exposed months ago and they'd no longer have a high reading. I am reading that that's why the authorities and the media are responding with so much gravity to the situation. 28 may not seem high in a population of 100,000 people, but 28 may be the tip of the iceberg. Are you disputing that?
I'm not disputing it. Look, what you just read has actually been cited numerous times in the last few weeks. This is nothing new, okay? Everybody knows that lead passes through the body fairly quickly. You and I, Mark, have lead in our bodies right now. Do you realize that? Every person on the planet has lead in their bodies. The question is, how high is the level? And what is the standard for being acceptable from a health standpoint? That's really the issue. Look, I welcome the EPA making an announcement yesterday that they're going to really double down on analyzing blood samples in Flint, trying to find out what the lead levels really are. I think it's very important. I think the study that Hurley Hospital, that Dr. Mona is associated with, partnering with Michigan State University to study children in Flint over a 3 to 5 year period, which as far as I can see is really unique. I mean, this is a trailblazing project over the next 3 to 5 years to study what are the effects of lead level elevation in developing children, let's say 2 to 3 years old under the age of 6. I think that's extremely important, and
okay,
that may be one good thing that comes out of this.
I've heard Governor Snyder. I heard Governor Snyder tell CBS News on Wednesday that Flint residents should assume their water is not safe to drink, at least for now. Is the governor overreacting?
If I was the governor at this point, with the pounding he's taken on this, and with the hysteria out there whipped up by the news media, I think he's saying absolutely the right thing. I mean, you know, discretion is the better part of valor, as they say. Be safe before you're sorry. Be concerned and till proven otherwise. Don't take any chances. Me, I'm not going to change my behavior in Flint and what I do because I know the situation.
Another quote of yours here, and I've got to ask you about this. I've never seen any evidence that they, referring to the people of Flint, have brown water. Bill, I can't watch a TV news account of this story without seeing a bottle of brown water being waved around.
Hold it, Mark. If I said that, you're taking it out of context. I said in my neighborhood, I've never seen any evidence of brown water. I've never disputed that there may be some people in Flint who have brown water, but the real question is, at this point, where is the brown water coming from? Okay, is it coming from the Flint River? Is it a result of something else? You had somebody on your program a little while ago, Mark, if memory serves me correctly, who wrote the book Tear Down. Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Well, guess what? It was about tearing down dilapidated and vandalized homes in the city of Flint. And there has been an epidemic of tear downs in Flint, of clouds of asbestos and lead in the atmosphere. There has been widespread arson in the city of Flint, destruction of property, lead everywhere. There is every reason to believe that a lot of the lead that may have seeped into homes in some areas comes from that rather than Flint River water, okay? But we don't really know. There is too much investigation that has to be done yet to find out the truth.
We're just about out of time here, Bill. I want to make sure I get a couple more questions in. One of the impacts of this has been that you're no longer associated with Inside Michigan Politics, the newsletter you yourself founded back in 1987. You're a regular on Off the Record with Tim Skubick on Michigan Public TV and WKAR as well. What's your status on Off the Record?
No change in status as far as I know.
You've not spoken with Tim about this?
I have spoken.
What's the conversation been like?
I just told you the answer.
Okay. You're still on board on Off the Record.
Well, as far as I know, why wouldn't I be?
But have you explicitly talked about that with Tim?
I have.
Okay.
Since I'm telling the truth, Mark, why wouldn't Tim or anybody else at WKR not want me on the show?
Well, your comments have triggered so much. I mean,
they've triggered comments, Mark, from people that you hear from, okay? Believe me, the comments I've heard from people in the last 48 hours are dramatically different from what you've been hearing. I've been hearing from have been saying, right on, finally, a voice of sanity, a voice of reason, who's trying to get at the truth rather than fanning the flames of hysteria, which is what has been going on.
One more question, we'll wrap up here. On the State of the State roundtable on Tuesday night, you also referred to Hurley Hospital physicians who you claim feel this is exaggerated. Clarify what you...
Yeah, I will, if you'll let me, okay? I have talked to physicians up in the Flint area. Some may be affiliated with Flint Hurley. I think they are. But I never went into Flint Hurley Hospital, although I did visit there 2 weeks ago on a completely different issue, and started asking questions about the Flint water system and getting opinions from doctors in Hurley about that. So if I left that impression, that is wrong. Either I misspoke or people heard it the wrong way or whatever. But I have talked to physicians in the Flint community who believe, yes, there could be some danger from lead elevated in blood, but we don't know all the answers, and the degree of coverage by the media approaches the level of hysteria. They have told me that.
Political commentator and journalist Bill Ballinger has been our guest here on Current State. Thank you, Bill.
You're welcome, Mark.
Brittany DeYoung performing on the harp here in Studio S on a Live Music Friday on WKAR's Current State. Brittany is the principal harpist with the Lansing Symphony Orchestra, and she's got a part here in Brooks' Scottish Symphony coming up Saturday night. We'll learn more about the program and more about Brittany DeYoung and her background as a harp player here coming up in the remaining minutes on Current State. Well, as the cold winter bears down on mid-Michigan, you might be keeping yourself warm with a quilt, maybe even one that's been in your family for quite some time, right? And this weekend, the Flint Institute of Arts opens an exhibit dedicated to this folk art. Current State's Jamie Paisley went to Flint for a preview of the exhibit and also got to speak with one of the quilting artists, Yvonne Wells, who might not be used to our Michigan cold, right, Jamie?
Yeah, when I heard that Ms. Wells, in her mid-70s, and I would not dare divulge the woman's exact age, of course, that Ms. Wells was coming to the Flint Institute of Arts here in Michigan, and from up in Alabama she's coming down from, and in January, well, I wanted to make sure she was ready for whatever the temperature was going to be.
I am. I think I have a precursor here in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. For the last 3 or 4 days, we have been extremely cold. So I have got myself ready. I'm prepared to inhale the cold temperatures that are there.
And I think the first quilt that you made had a similar kind of, you were cold when you made it.
My oldest daughter graduated from high school in 79. So I was making quilts, or trying to make quilts in 1979, that she could at least have something to carry with her at that time. I was making these funny-looking traditional quilts, pattern quilts, trying to make them, but every time I made them, they didn't look like anything that I had seen, but they looked good to me. So one day on the floor, while I was stepping on fabrics and all kinds of notions, I said, I think I can make a story. So I laid it all out there on the floor, which was our game room, and everything was in there, ping pong table and everything. We played and did everything in this big room. And I laid it out there, and I made the crucifixion. That was my first, to me, my first story quilt. It was very simple at that time, and it was so satisfying to see the completion of one of the things that I had been seeing and feeling all along, and to see it come to fruition. It was almost mind-boggling. I had done this. Because if you know me, if you ever get a chance to know me, you know that I don't do anything that is done perfect. Everything I do is kind of out of the norm.
It's taken you a whole lot of places, too. Even the White House, I understand. Tell me about the first time you heard that you were going to be showing something at the White House.
I didn't go to the White House, but my quilt was not commissioned, but I was invited to make a piece for the Blue Room. And I did that when the Clintons were in power. At the recommendation of Michael Moore, he was the director of the Renwick Gallery and Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. So I made this stuffed heart and an outline of the state of Alabama, putting on it some of the interesting points of Alabama. So when I did send it there, and when in the, during the process, I was so excited when I got this information that they wanted it, that I was selected. I called directly to the White House, to the Blue Room, and I talked with somebody there, and that was even more important to me than it was making the quilts, because I didn't ever think I could dial the White House from my house. That was amazing.
that's putting it very mildly, amazing. Holy cow, wow. We're speaking with Ms. Vaughn Wells, Alabama quilter who created about a third of the quilts that'll be on display starting this weekend at the Flint Institute of Arts exhibit From Heart to Hand, an exhibition of African-American quilts organized by the Montgomery Museum of Fine Arts in Montgomery, Alabama. And Ms. Wells, one of the story quilts on display has to do with a big moment in sports history. What is that quilt?
The Great American Pastime. Homage to Jackie Robinson. And you can look at that and see that I use a lot of funny things, and you will see a complete team that's on the field. And also, which is interesting, and somebody brought it to my attention, is to make sure that when you talk about this quilt, they will look up in the stand and see the birds eating popcorn that somebody had spilled. I said, okay. And also, Ms. Wells, make sure that they see the little bat that's in the on-deck circle. And it's not a piece of fabric. It is a button in the shape of a bat. See, when I go out and just look around, like I'm not looking for anything in particular, but I'm looking for things. And I would just pick and buy it. I would buy it and just bring it home. And one day, something is going to come into my mind that I need to put this on. So when I saw this button, I said, now, oh, yeah, this is exactly what I need. So I brought it home, and then a year maybe so afterwards, I incorporated it into the Great American Pastime.
So after speaking with quilter Yvonne Wells, I went to the Flint Institute of Arts to speak with Tracy Glab, curator of collections and exhibitions at FIA, and to see this display of 30 quilts, which comprises the exhibition called From Heart to Hand. Now, while the quilt gallery opens to the public on Sunday, there is a way, Tracy explains, to see them, as well as quilter Yvonne Wells, in person.
It is our preview of the exhibition. It's a ticketed event. Members are $35 and non-members are $50. But it includes a great array of activities, including at the very start, a conversation with artist Yvonne Wells, whose quilts are featured in the show, and curator Stephanie James from the Mott Warsh Collection in Flint. They're both going to have a Q&A, a conversation about her work, about Wells's work. And then after that is followed by a reception, preview of the exhibition, and live music. And that goes up until about 9:30.
And then the opening proper of the quilts is going to be on Sunday?
On Sunday, the next day, and it is going to be free. It's sponsored by First Merit Bank.
Will Yvonne be here for that one as well?
No, unfortunately she returns to Alabama where she lives the next day.
And a lot of what I'm seeing in the gallery right now, there's a lot of fairly patterned work, but there's also a few storied quilts.
Sure.
Could you talk about those differences?
Sure. Well, we start the exhibition with a section titled Tradition. And that's where you're going to see the basic quilt patterns, the things that people are most used to, like log cabin and star pattern. But then the second section is called improvisation, and that is where artists really start to take those patterns and do interesting things with them. They do a riff on it, so like jazz. The last section is called narrative or storytelling, and that is where, as you mentioned, the quilts come into play that are more about narrative, a story either from a fable, from the Bible, or from history.
We're in front of one of Yvonne Wells's, a very red one, very brightly red, and it is Yesterday, Civil Rights in the South 3. How would you describe what we're seeing in this tableau?
Sure. Well, it is really the epitome of a storytelling quilt, because what Ms. Wells has done here is she has shown several stories within one quilt. It goes all the way back to the Mayflower in the lower right-hand corner, through cotton picking, lynching, Rosa Parks bus stand, up to the Birmingham bombing of a church, and on and on and on. And in the exhibition, we are going to have a didactic panel next to the quilt, which will explain what each symbol represents. And Yvonne has taken great pains to include details like segregated water fountains to show the civil rights struggle in Alabama.
And I see the state capitol as well. And what are the flags that are in ascending order up there?
Correct. So she's shown the state capitol in Montgomery with the Confederate flag, which flew there until it was moved off-site, and then now it's completely removed. But at the time that she made this quilt, it was still flying in the state capitol.
So there is a set of 30 various quilts that we're looking at. How were they all assembled?
Well, it's very interesting because, in a sense, these quilts are making a homecoming being here in Flint, because they were all collected by a Michigan collector from Birmingham named Kemp Hogan. He collected these quilts over 17 years. He collected 48 quilts, and 30 of them are going to be on view here in Flint. But he donated them. He thought it was very important that they stay in the state that they were made. So he donated them to the Montgomery Museum of Fine Arts for that reason. But because they're here temporarily on exhibit, they are coming back to Michigan.
Curator of the Flint Institute of Arts, Tracy Glab, on the display opening this weekend, From Heart to Hand, an exhibition of African-American quilts organized by the Montgomery Museum of Fine Arts in Montgomery, Alabama. You can find more information about this exhibit, including those story quilts by Yvonne Wells, which runs through April 10th at flintarts.com. For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
The 2013 documentary Detropia focuses on Detroit's decades-long decline, its citizens, and the effort to bring the city back. Detropia airs this evening at 7 o'clock on WKAR World. Heidi Ewing is the co-director of Detropia. Here's part of a 2013 Current State interview with Ewing as she describes some of Detropia's central figures and their motivations.
We looked at Baltimore, we were looking into New York City, and Detroit came up. We can experiment here.
If you look at all of the main characters in our film, including Crystal, George, and Mistress Tommy Stevens, The subtext, of course, is that all of those individuals have the resources to leave Detroit. They don't have to be there, and they choose to stay. And Mr. Stevens chooses to keep the Raven nightclub open, and George McGregor chooses to continue at the union, even though he could walk away with a pension. Crystal Starr is a smart 20-something Detroiter who clearly has the, you know, wherewithal, brains, and ambition to leave if she chose to. So for me, actually, all of the subjects in the film represent the can-do spirit of Detroit, because they don't have to live there. And so while we don't come out and say it explicitly with all of the characters, that is something that is true about all of them.
Part of an interview there with Heidi Ewing, co-director of the 2013 documentary Detropia. It airs this evening at 7 on WKAR World. Its current state on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Residents of Washington, D.C. are talking about the snowstorm headed for the city, but at the U.S. Conference of Mayors, the hot conversation is all about lead. Mayors from across the country are taking in the lessons of the Flint water crisis. Among them is Lansing Mayor Virge Bernero, who, of course, leads a community just 50 miles away. Current State's Kevin Lavery joins me now. Kevin, what does Mayor Bernero have to say about what's going on?
Well, Mark, Mr. Bernero tells me he's having some good talks with Flint Mayor Karen Weaver, as well as mayors from a few other Michigan cities. Certainly, Lansing has its own issues to contend with. Among them is a $650 million retiree health care and pension obligation. We'll hear about that topic here coming up in a moment. But first, I asked Virge Bernero about the Michigan story that is making headlines around the world.
Mayors everywhere are amazed, shocked, and appalled at what's happened in Flint. And it's a cautionary tale for sure. And I am, of course, making it an issue, working with the mayors. The mayor of Pontiac is here. The mayor of Benton Harbor is here. The mayor of Flint has been here. So that soon we will have some policies, some recommendations, and some protocol to raise the bar, to have standards on what these emergency managers can do. Because, look, they can leave devastation in the wake, obviously. Most importantly and most impactful right now is to deal with the crisis at hand and to make sure that people have one of the vital necessities of life, which is water. I mean, what's happened where you have the state come in and say, we're from the state, we're here to help you, and leave a city, take a city like Flint that is essentially on its knees and kick them in the teeth and put them on the ground. I mean, it is ground zero of a major disaster.
So along those lines, what did you make of Governor Snyder's plans outlining what he intends to do in his State of the State address?
I think it's a start. I think that the state has had a very slow and sluggish beginning. This is a beginning. The governor said that the buck stops with him. Well, I can tell you the buck certainly starts with him because he, the emergency manager, reported directly to him. He made the decision to remove the mayor, to remove the local authority, and replace it with state authority. And so he's responsible, and I appreciate that he acknowledges that. I believe in deeds, not words, and there's a lot of deeds that are going to have to be done.
We're talking with Lansing Mayor Virge Bernero, who right now is in Washington, D.C. at the U.S. Conference of Mayors. We'll come back to your favorite topic now, Mayor, which is your city, Lansing. Lately, there's been some pretty big news with developments, the redevelopment plans for the Michigan School for the Blind. This is a partnership between the city and TWG Development. The main building is going to be transformed into some 130 family and senior housing units. My question, though, to you is that a few years ago, the site had already been approved by the Council for Redevelopment. What happened to those plans then, and will this development become more successful than what we thought the original would be?
Well, you know what they say, the third time's the charm. I'm hoping the second time is the charm. Look, we make announcements when we think a project is ripe. That didn't work out. I think this time we've hit pay dirt. I think we've got the right company, the right time, the right team, the right project, and we're very excited. This is a $24 million investment in the heart of the city. So we're trying to provide options. We want people living in Lansing. So it's a very exciting project, and again, it's not any one demographic, but it's all that we're trying to serve in Lansing. People of all ages, people of all ethnicities. We are, a multicultural city.
Let me switch over to finances for a moment here. The Lansing Financial Health Team has been operating for more than 2 years studying the finances. The team is set to release a report soon about this, and the team estimates Lansing is on the hook for about $400 million in unfunded health care liabilities, about $250 million in pension obligations. The team has said publicly that Lansing has the highest unfunded liability of any city in Michigan. So looking at $650 million in obligations, what is your strategy for paying that off in the long run?
Well, my strategy, Kevin, first of all, was to not bury my head in the sand and pretend that the money, that this debt didn't exist. And the truth is that this is far enough away, Kevin, that I could afford to ignore it. I mean, I could probably be mayor another 5 or 10 years, and this would not affect us immediately. But in the long run, it spells potential financial disaster. And I'm not content to just hand over a hot potato to the next mayor and let them deal with it. So we set aside $100 million in our budget. The city council agreed with me that we should spend that. We know it's going to cost about $200,000 to do a study to really give us get some of the top experts, because even the experts that we have don't feel quite up to the task of really digging into that, what you say, those financial numbers, and giving us their best guess. So we set aside $100,000. The state has agreed to match that $100,000. So we're prepared to do a $200,000 study, bring in one of the top consulting firms to lay out how bad is the problem and what are our best options for solving it. And we're not adding to the problem. The other thing is we've saved $200 million in long-term cuts. In terms of what I'm going to do, Kevin, we've gotten our unions. You know, we've talked turkey. We've really had tough negotiations with our unions, and I got to say they've stepped up. I got to say, you know, the Teamsters, the UAW, the police, the fire, they have sacrificed. They've made changes. And so already we've got $200 million in savings, but it's not enough. We know we have to do more, but we need help to figure out what that strategy should be. But the good news for Lansing residents and those of the region is that we're not just comfortable. We're not just burying our head in the sands and hoping for the best. We are getting the best minds. We're putting our shoulders to the wheel, and we will have answers. We will have options soon.
We're talking with Virge Brunero. He's the mayor of the city of Lansing. He's right now in Washington at the U.S. Conference of Mayors. Mr. Mayor, it's January, and some people are noticing that you're not planning on giving a State of the City address, as you've done historically in the past. Instead, you're looking to talk with the City Council more like March about the city and about the budget. Why the decision not to have a formal address this year?
Oh, I'll do a formal address in March. I've just moved it. And frankly, it's just I'm finally correcting something that I've been meaning to do for a long time. It was only tradition that led to the State of the City being done in January. And part of the reason I'm moving it to March is what we're talking about right now. January is a very busy time. It always has been. It's just completely jammed up. It'll be much easier. It'll be much less compressed. I think it'll be a better speech. And, you know, we'll have more time to really develop the themes and set an agenda, you know, and people will get used to it. It'll be from March to March. And I think not only will it be better for us, I think the future mayors will thank me that they will have less things jammed into January. So it really is just a logistical issue. And it also puts us closer to the introduction of the budget, which happens in March. So we'll be able to sort of link the message with the budget and the money that helps pay for that agenda.
Another topic is regionalism. That's been one of your buzz phrases for quite some time. And especially as we go forward into 2016, what can residents of Lansing and this entire region or the surrounding communities look forward to? I know that one topic has been the discussion of a possible regional fire authority. Lansing and East Lansing already share Randy Talaferro as the fire chief.
Randy Talaferro has done a yeoman's job, just a phenomenal job as chief of two departments, Lansing and East Lansing. This was a first for our region. I mean, these are two of the biggest departments, or the biggest departments in the region. So it was a big, big job. He's done it admirably. And that has helped to build trust, I think, in the fire service, not just between Lansing and East Lansing, but he is recognized as a regional leader. They have been in talks, the fire professionals, for some time, and I think we are moving toward a regional fire authority. Randy has put together a white paper that identifies that. More study will need to go into it. But, you know, these things don't happen overnight. It took a lot of years for us to get, for example, a combined 911 center. The county now runs that. It's one 911 for the whole county. That took over a decade to accomplish. But to have the closest vehicle respond, regardless of the unit, regardless of the jurisdiction. And most of us would agree that the closest unit, if you're having a heart attack, if you're having a medical incident, you don't really care about the patch on the uniform. It's about getting there first. And so we're going to first move towards something like that. Mainly, my mantra, Kevin, is regional support for regional facilities. You know, if people are using something regional, we have such great regional assets in Metro Lansing. And I think really the sky's the limit when it comes to regionalism. We are not prideful. I mean, we're proud of what we've got, but, you know, in Lansing, we don't have to run it. Our position isn't we run it and you pay for it. Our position is we're willing to see things move to the county, like the zoo The county now runs it. It's a county facility. The river trails. The fire service. If we have a regional fire authority, that doesn't have to be under the mayor's control. There needs to be political accountability, of course, to elected officials. But our position isn't that Lansing has to run it. We're willing to give things up, but for the good of the region. We think that more and more services are that way. We think our citizens are open to that. You've got people that live in Lansing and work in Okemos, or live in Okemos and work in Lansing. We're all one Metro Lansing community, and I think we can save money and provide better services when we think and act regionally.
As we said, Mr. Mayor, you are in D.C. for the U.S. Conference of Mayors. Are you picking up a few nuggets of truth from your peers that you'd like to try out when you come back home?
Always, Kevin, always. There have been great sessions on metro economic communities, on law enforcement, and just a whole host of other issues. And sometimes those, sometimes you realize right then as you're taking notes, sometimes it hits you on the plane on the way back. But there's no question, I always learn from my peers. These are great opportunities. Right now, there's a little bit of a state of panic because there's been snow on the ground, and there's a big storm expected to hit. And so really, the whole city is preoccupied. So right now, we could teach them a thing or two about salting and sanding and shoveling, because they are petrified of a few inches of snow down here. And so those of us from Michigan and Ohio and New York are kind of chuckling. But the city is just absolutely paranoid about what's coming. And that's hanging over us like a pall over the whole conference. But there's always that great exchange, some of it informally, just in the lobby, some of the great exchanges I've had. You'd think that I would talk to Michigan mayors, you know, in Michigan, but yet some of the great exchanges I've had here with the mayor from Pontiac and the mayor of Benton Harbor and Flint have been, you know, with Michigan mayors right here. Because even in Michigan, you know, we're busy doing our thing. We're busy running our cities. And so we don't have much opportunity to talk. So, again, so I do see mayors from all over the country, and it's great to catch up and see what they're up to. And you learn in little bits and pieces. But some of the greatest exchanges I've had here have been with the Michigan mayors.
Verge Brunero is the mayor of the city of Lansing. We've been talking about a number of projects and some challenges for the city in the coming year. He joined us on the line from the U.S. Conference of Mayors in Washington, D.C. Mr. Mayor, thank you again for your time. Please don't get snowed in and hurry back.
Thank you so much. Look forward to seeing you soon, Kevin.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
And Brittany DeYoung is our Live Music Friday guest here this week on WKAR's Current State. She's the principal harpist with the Lansing Symphony Orchestra, our first ever harpist on Current State. She'll perform at tomorrow night's LSO concert at the Wharton Center and at a family program at the downtown Lansing Library on Sunday afternoon. Let's listen to a piece. This is the Danse de Mogique by Marcel Tournier. What a sound. Brittany DeYoung on the harp here. She is the principal harpist with the Lansing Symphony Orchestra, and that was the Danse de Musique by Marcel Tournier. Welcome to Current State.
Well, thank you.
You come from out west. At what age did you start playing the harp?
I started when I was 8 years old. My family was really musical, and we were all encouraged to perform and play music.
This is a large instrument. A younger, smaller person must have a smaller instrument, I presume?
Yes, they have.
I hope so.
They have lever harps, which are about 3/4 of the size, and they have levers that adjust the pitches rather than the pedals on the bottom of the larger instruments.
How tough physically is it to be a harpist?
It is an incredibly physically demanding instrument. You're using your hands, your feet, your back when you're sitting behind the harp and it's resting on your shoulder.
It's a good upper body workout.
Yes, it is.
Really. And yes. Do you get, I am assuming you get calluses from plucking the strings?
Oh, yeah. Very large calluses on every finger. So.
Yeah. Now, Saturday night's LSO concert features guest violinist Rachel Barton Pine playing Brooks' Scottish Fantasy. You'll also perform on that piece. How does this work, rehearsing a concert like this with a guest artist?
Oh, it's wonderful. We will rehearse together as a group before she comes in, and so that we kind of know the piece before she gets there. And then when she comes in, it really comes together as a full piece, and it's just a beautiful, beautiful piece of music that we're going to be doing.
How much classical music includes any part at all for a harp?
You know, it's much more of the more recent kind of modern and romantic era music that has harp, because the instrument took several years to develop, and it wasn't until 1810 that the pedal harp was even invented. And so anything before that, really the harp was not used.
But does the symphony, does the symphony typically perform pieces that don't require you?
About half of the time I'll play.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, whether it's one piece or the full concert, sometimes I don't play on any concert at all.
We also want to talk about your performance this Sunday at an LSO family series at the library. It's called Harp Harmonies, 3 p.m. Sunday, and the LSO says it's perfect for kids ages 2 to 10. What happens at this?
Yeah, I'm going to be playing some fun music that's accessible to young children, something they can kind of get exposed to classical music with, and possibly even have a chance to play the harp if they're interested.
It must mesmerize a lot of young kids. I'm sure it will on Sunday afternoon. We'll let you make your way back to the harp. Brittany DeYoung has been our guest. We want to thank her here on for being our performer on Live Music Friday. Monday on Current State, college is hard enough already, but imagine trying to get your degree while worrying about things like your next meal and where you're going to sleep. That was the reality for Eastern Michigan University student Ramon Williams until the community pulled together to support him. He was homeless. We'll talk with Ramon Williams and with the woman who created the campaign to help him out. We want to thank Brittany DeYoung, our performer here on Live Music Friday. She's going to play us out. This is called Dewdrops by Godefroy on Current State.